Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. If you work in drinks and it feels as if the party is over, you're not imagining it. Volumes are soft, margins are under pressure, and everyone's got their own favourite villain. Is it Gen Z? Tariffs, cannabis, gaming, health and wellness? Who is it? But which of these things actually matter? And which are just industry scare stories? To sort signal from the noise, I've brought in someone whose job is literally to put numbers on all of this. Today's guest is Ed Mundy, Managing Director, Beverages Research at Jefferies, the largest pure play investment bank in the US. Ed sits in London, but his coverage runs across beer, spirits and soft drinks from mature markets to fast-growing emerging ones. If investors want to know which drinks companies to buy, sell or just avoid, he's the man to call. Over this last summer, Ed and his team pulled the whole picture apart and they identified 27 separate headwinds facing beverage alcohol. That's right, 27. They surveyed 3,600 consumers around the world and tried to answer the question that everyone's asking. Is this just a temporary downturn or has something fundamental changed? In this episode, we're going to walk through those 27 headwinds, group them into the big forces reshaping the market, and then come back to that central question. When will it all end and what has to change before growth comes back? Ed, lovely to see you. Can we start by you telling me, what is a beverage analyst and what do you do?
So what is a beverage analyst? So I worked for Jefferies, which is a US investment bank. We're the largest pure play investment bank. We're headquartered in the US, but I work out of their London office. And my role as a beverage analyst is to provide, research and recommendations on stocks and sectors to help investors make investment decisions, which stocks to buy or sell, essentially. And a big part of the job is modeling, a big part of the job is writing. But a really important part of the job is engaging with the investment community and also corporates on the sector and trying to identify what the big questions are of the day and trying to answer them.
Did you mean to go into this sector or is it something you fell into?
So finance I sort of fell into, but left university with a history degree and then moved into finance as a chartered accountant, which was an amazing grounding and some brilliant people that I met along the way, but really wanted to work into a sector that was relatable, such as consumer goods. And, during my accountancy qualification, did a couple of wine courses, fortunate enough to do them at the Wines and Spirits Educational Trust. And that really, piqued my interest. And on qualifying, I moved into the alcoholic drinks industry initially as in a beer company within their corporate M&A department. And then, moved into my current role as an analyst in a bank.
Am I right that you also deal with soft drinks?
Correct. So we do beers, we do spirits, we also do soft drinks, and we focus on the soft drinks bottlers in Europe. I've got a colleague in the US who focuses on Coke and Pepsi, but yeah, we look at the full gamut across beverages, and then we've got other analysts who look at, tobacco, other analysts who look at food, household products, that type of thing.
All right. Now, one of the reasons I want to talk to you is you did some very interesting research over summer. Can you go through what you did and why?
Sure. So, this is an industry that's been through several years of, really attractive growth, a couple of ups and downs, with the cycle, such as the global financial crisis. But, it's been a really, really good couple of decades of growth across beverage alcohol, whether that's on spirits or beer. And, that growth clearly accelerated, during the pandemic period. And then, we came off the back of the pandemic and growth was sluggish initially and has stayed sluggish. So, the work we did over the summer was to really try and look at the future of alcohol. And we sort of split it into a trilogy of reports. The first one was to sort of look at what's actually happened to the growth industry and try and separate facts from fiction. And we identified lots and lots of headwinds facing the sector. The second one was, instead of what we think, we asked consumers what they thought, and we did a 3,600 personal survey across mature and also developing markets, which, you know, quite interesting to compare and contrast across the regions. And then the third report was to really bring the two together. So what we thought alongside what the survey thought, and what does that mean for growth? I'm sure we'll go into some of the conclusions, but overall, we don't see a material change in the, you know, emerging and developing markets. You know, Europe's always been quite sluggish generally, but the cycle might still have further to run within the big US market.
Okay, so you identified multiple headwinds. Before we get into sort of drilling down on some of the things that you found, what are the main headwinds that the alcohol sector is looking at?
Sure. So, yeah, 27 different headwinds that were identified. And
27.
I suppose a few.
That's a lot.
Yes, that is a lot. And, you know, I think it was important to try and, you know, spread the net as far and wide as possible, because this is one of those sectors that, you know, the barriers to entry to understanding consumer goods are not that hard, you know, insofar as, you know, everyone's got a view, right? And therefore, we thought it was really, really important to try and separate fact from fiction, because there's a tendency of proximity bias. You know, you see what's around you in your closest surroundings, what your friends are doing, what your family's doing, and you extrapolate those trends on sort of the global universe, if you will. But if we were to take those 27 different things and put them into a couple of really big buckets, I mean, the first bucket, you know, would be a sort of macro external piece. And that's everything from, you know, cost of living, money, inflation, higher commodities, tariffs, as well as some of the external factors, you know, such as tariffs and various other things that are disrupting that tend to be cyclical, number one. There was a second one which we identified as health. And that encompasses everything from the perception of health, self-prohibition, you know, all the way through to GLP drugs. The third one that we identified was the social relevance of alcohol. You know, people have been, you know, drinking alcohol for 8,000 years. There's something fundamentally changed how we think about alcohol. You know, young people, are we older cohorts, for instance, as well as, you know, have we got other ways to, you know, get a buzz, you know, through, you know, edibles and the rest of it. And then the fourth one we looked at was, you know, marketing and innovation. You know, a lot of the first three were really external factors, whereas the fourth one's more company specific, industry specific. You know, has the innovation been good enough? Has the marketing been good enough? Is it fit for purpose? Or is it a little bit missing the mark? So 27 different things, and try to distill them into four specific subgroups that are quite distinct.
All right, let's take those one by one. Tariffs, how much of an impact have tariffs actually had? So I know the Italian wine sector came out a couple of months ago and said that it's had I wish I could remember the figure, but it was quite an extraordinary impact on their exports. But what are you seeing elsewhere?
So clearly it's a very diverse view depending on sort of where you are in the world, of course. But the two biggies that have impacted the alcoholic drink sector, certainly for the listed companies, has been the tariffs going into the US on the one hand. But it's, you know, there's lots of carve outs, you know, tequila coming in or Canadian whiskey coming in, you know, I've got a carve out there. But certainly European products going over to the US, you know, still quite high tariffs, albeit not to the same extent as some of the threatened tariffs. So look, the tariffs are important. They drive, you know, clearly volatility. They push up pricing. They drive fluctuations in inventory as people, you know, stock up ahead of tariffs. But I think relative to the impact of the strong euro relative to the dollar, I think the euro impact's probably more actually with the dollar having weakened and the euro having strengthened in terms of what that means for you know, the cost of doing business if you're an exporter into the US. So yes, look, the tariffs are important, but I'd say the currency pieces are even probably more important.
That's interesting.
And then the second one has been obviously in China, where it hasn't really been about tariffs, but it's been about this anti-dumping investigation, which has clearly gone away, but it has led to a lot of uncertainty and a lot of volatility there. And a similar thing in terms of inventory, trade load, and we can go on to China later in terms of some of the other pressures there as well.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody yesterday, an analyst from one of the big companies, who said that the tariffs might never go away because they're making the US administration so much money that just it's brought billions and billions of dollars into the treasury. Do you have a view on that?
it's hard to say. I mean, never's a strong word, of course. You've still got a couple more years of the current administration. And, you know, I think historically what we have seen is you've seen that, you know, the bark was worse than the bite. That was certainly during the first administration. You know, second time round, there's, you know, clearly been a little bit more follow through in terms of that. But, you know, even this week, there's some talk of some of the tariffs on food being removed because it, you know, it's driving up inflation, and that's, you know, unhelpful for consumers. And, you know, one of the
except
problems I think in the US
pasta.
Is indeed.
It's getting but, a 300% tariff.
Yeah. But, you know, you do get carve-outs from time to time. I mean, cork was included in the original tariffs and then that was excluded. So, you know, that's... I would expect tariffs to be a bit of a moving feast over the next couple of years. That's how I sort of think about it.
All right. So that's tariffs. Let's talk about the health part of the piece. What were you hearing from people?
So... in the survey that we did of 3,600 people, you know, clearly when you do a survey, you know, everyone underreports how much they drink, which is, you know, quite an interesting part of the survey. A bit like, you know, when you go into the doctor and he asks you how much you drink, and the degree of underreporting was pretty severe. So people actually say they drink 25% of what they actually drink per the statistics. So that's quite interesting, number one. So huge amount of underreporting.
If you go to a doctor in Australia now, one of the first questions they ask you is, you know, how much you drink. And because I'm a wine judge, I just go, not much, except then it's sometimes 50 a day. And they never know what to do. Yes. So how do you calculate the underreporting? Do you just match it against the excise paid of, you know, an economy? Or how do you know how much people underreport?
Yeah, so we can look at, you know, per capita consumption, you know, that's given by the World Health Organization. We can cross-reference that to, you know, IWSR that, you know, gives you a really, really good steer. And, you know, of course, averages are very misleading, right? But, you know, you've got a pretty decent idea of, you know, how much people drink. And maybe people just, you know, don't know how to, maybe they underreport or they don't know how to account for it. But the degree of underreporting was quite extreme. But that's not to say that there isn't value in the survey, because what's interesting in the survey is less about what they actually, you know, claim they drink, and it's more around how perceptions towards alcohol differ across age cohorts, across income groups, you know, across different regions, and then also to compare those against the last time we ran the survey, which was 4 years ago. And that's where you can try and glean, you know, some of the conclusions, essentially. But to answer your question on health, you know, when you... you know, ask people, you know, why do you, well, number one, do you plan to drink less or more over the next 6 months? You know, pretty much everyone says they plan to drink less.
But, was that true 4 years ago?
I think it was true 4 years ago, yeah. I mean, people, you know, also right. say they plan to drink a little bit less. I mean, the emerging markets, they're not necessarily saying they're going to drink less. That's quite an interesting part of it. But, you know, when you look at the reasons why they plan to drink less, which is the interesting part, I think, it's not necessarily, you know, weight loss drugs. It's not sort of anxiety about being seen drunk online. It's not because you're sort of, you know, on social media at home. It's health, number one, right? I plan to drink less because of health reasons. It's fitness goals, number two. So again, that sort of fits into health. And then number three, it's money. And then number four, it's mental health. So quite interesting when you look at it across a global level, but when you drill into different companies, you do see different conclusions as to why people plan to drink less.
And what are you seeing across different age cohorts?
So it's true, younger consumers do drink less. And then the next generation up, so 25 onwards, I mean, that's the sort of one of the bigger age cohorts in terms of frequency and intensity. And then that carries through to the next age cohort. And then as you get older, it sort of starts to fade off a little bit. So that's the first point. Look, it is true. People do drink less. They probably drink a little bit less intensely, a little bit less frequently in terms of that younger legal drinking age consumer. But what's interesting is if you compare those consumers from, you know, 2021 to the consumers in 2025 who've graduated until up to the next age cohort, right, is you see that the consumption trends do tend to normalize. So they tend to drink more. So one of the conclusions I think from that is that, you know, as you earn a little bit more money, you become a little bit stable, you probably move out of home, get a bit more independence, you start socializing as an adult. Your drinking patterns do tend to normalize. Now, that's not to say that younger generations, it's pretty clear that younger generations do drink less, but I think to say they drink less and they will always drink less, I think is up to debate. Given the data would suggest that as they grow up, they tend to drink a little bit more.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I was in the United States in October, and in the US, they're all saying, a lot of people haven't reached legal drinking age yet, so you can't make any conclusions. And I was like, well, overseas they have. They hit that at 18, so you should already start to see those trends overseas. So this is a really interesting debate, because I've read what banks have to say about this, and all of the economic people are saying what you're saying, which is that it will normalize as people get older. But then there's a whole bunch of public health research, because they've been very interested in this as well, and they've been sort of doing narrative reviews and discussions with young people since 1971. And what they're saying is that this is the first time they've seen these behaviors in young people, that young people are very risk averse. They're not taking drugs. They're not getting pregnant. They're not doing a whole lot of behaviors. And I'm just wondering, do you think, how much do you take all of the sociology into consideration?
Well, I think it's incredibly important, right? And, I think COVID, the impact of COVID is going to take 10 years to get over, frankly. I mean, it's going to be a COVID sort of decade. So, look, I think we've still got quite a long time of, people coming out of the anxiety of COVID as well, and, having missed out on so many opportunities. And, you've got social media involved in the whole debate as well. So, look, I think your point is a good one. I think that the social element of this is incredibly important. And how you change that is going to be interesting. And I think, one of the key questions, for these companies, because you are seeing drinks. I mean, we spend a lot of time looking at the US industry, and, some of the drinks that are absolutely flying off the shelves are specifically targeted at that younger legal drinking age consumer. Yeah, the like formats XXL. Are, yeah, well, XXL or Beatbox or Buzzballs. Not only are they cheap and the out-of-pocket, ticket price is quite low, not only are they convenient, but, if you look at sort of one of the reasons why they're doing so well is they're fun. The marketing is a little bit different. The flavors and the innovation are, really, really different. They're very clear on the packaging in terms of, how many calories there are and what the alcohol dosage is. Your point around sort of safety is incredibly important. I mean, these things can't be spiked. So
yeah, I think that's interesting.
It's really interesting to sort of see that, look, there is growth out there. And these drinks are not sort of necessarily aimed at you and me, to be clear.
You have no idea how cheap I can get it.
But, the flavors are fun and the price points, really, really low. I mean, we did a note on this week, just looking at this new cocktail that's going slightly viral, the BBC, the Buzzball Beatbox Cutwater cocktail. And it's essentially $1 a unit when you break it down into some of the parts, and you compare that to, $10 a unit if you're having a cocktail, in the on-trade in Manhattan. So, look, I know that that's not necessarily the target audience you're going after, but, there is a huge affordability piece, huge affordability play, for some of these brands, but also you can't get away from the fact that the marketing, the taste profiles are more fun. So, how you bring consumers, especially these younger legal drinking age consumers, into the category, I think is a really, really important point and one that's very, very relevant for this industry in developed markets. I think the emerging markets, you're still seeing that recruitment coming through from, younger legal drinking age consumers. That comes through loud and clear on the survey. And I think the sort of social relevance of alcohol in the emerging markets is still alive and well. People want to have that first drink as a social lubricant, makes them have a better time or have a good time. And that comes through, loud and clear in the survey.
When you say emerging market, are you talking about a market like Brazil or a market like Nigeria?
But both. So we'd characterize, these markets as, having population growth, urbanization, middle class growth, rising disposable income, markets where, I guess the health considerations are less relevant, markets where, you look at Africa, what, 60% of the population's, under 30. I mean, there's a very, very strong demographic tailwind there. And, the things that the industry talks about, marijuana, GLP drugs, they're frankly just not relevant in those markets. What is relevant is that first bucket I talked about, which is, money, external factors, tariff uncertainty, those types of economic factors, as well as regulation that you're seeing in China at the moment in a big way. Those factors are very, very relevant.
Yeah. I've just got two more questions about health. One is about the GLPs. Now, we're hearing a lot about it, but hearing a lot about it isn't data. What are you actually seeing in terms of how they are influencing the market?
So GLPs are really interesting because certainly, in the investment world, everyone knows someone who's either on it or, everyone's got a view of it, right? And it becomes very anecdotal. And you can't say it's not having an impact, right? Because, everyone that's on the GLPs is, cutting back to some extent, right? But when you look at the actual data, and you've got to look at it sort of 6 months post-adoption, right? And there's a couple of conclusions. I think the first conclusion is that there are very, very few categories across consumer staples where there's actually a positive impact, right? Those categories are things like yogurt. Yogurt's viewed as a superfood because it's protein. Obviously, meat products as well. Some of the sort of the snack meat products have gone up relative to the baseline.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes, because, people need protein because they're, not starving themselves, but, they're cutting back on calories. So they need the protein so they don't wither away, right? And then at the other end of the extreme, you can imagine, what is getting cut back in a big way. So, cookies, crisps, chocolate, all these types of very sugary, high processed, foods that are, very calorie heavy. Clearly people are cutting back on them. But when you look at the data, and obviously the US is the market that's most developed from a GLP-1 weight loss drug standpoint, water is slightly down, ever so slightly down, because, people drink less water because they're more full, number one. And then alcohol comes next.
I would never have predicted that. Okay, and alcohol is next.
But alcohol comes one next to water. And again, you've got to double click on that number to really understand why. And the reason why is that the diabetics, i.e. the people that GLP-1 drugs were initially intended for, they're not drinking in the first place. Right, because they're not well, and what have you. So, the impact of on the diabetic population on alcohol is basically negligible, right? And then the impact on the non-diabetics is there is some impact, but it's much, much less than the fatty foods of the crisps and the chocolates. It's just a more sort of quote unquote normal impact, and that's the reason why. The impact of GLP is not as pronounced. Now, that's not to say that it's not a risk for the future, right? When it moves from injectable to pill format.
Does the guy in charge of fast-moving consumer food at Jefferies go around looking really sad at the moment? Is that a category in decline?
I mean, US food's been under pressure for a while. It's quite commoditized. There's a big private label piece. There's been a huge inflation. So yeah, I'd say food is one of the more tricky parts of the industry. It's not the most buoyant part.
Do you see private label as a headwind for alcohol? Because the private label share is starting to go up in the US.
Yeah, I mean, historically it hasn't really been a headwind because just the way the duty works, of course, right? If you're comparing, booze relative to dishwasher tablets, let's say. So you go out and buy your fancy dishwasher tablets that are the all singing, all dancing ones, and then you compare that to, the private label dishwasher tablets at, a quarter of the price, and it's very, very easy to downtrade and save money. But, just given how much excise duty is paid, in particular in Europe, the saving from downtrading from, a mainstream vodka, let's say, to a really, really cheap own label vodka is nowhere near as pronounced. So look, I think there is an element of protection against private label penetration because of the regulatory piece. And I think that the second thing as well is that, people are very emotional about their brands as well. So they've all got their favorite brands. So again, you're just not seeing a lot of private label growing, you know, within beer, for instance. And, you know, these are big category drivers, you know, for these big supermarkets. And the same is true for soft drinks. I mean, private label penetration for soft drinks is teeny tiny because the retailers make so much money from selling Coke and Pepsi and Red Bull. So I think beverage alcohol and broader beverages is quite well protected. Now, you know, these ready-to-drinks, which we touched on earlier, they're a form of private label, right? Because, you know, they're very, very cheap. You know, they're coming in at the very lowest end and they're bringing consumers there. And I think the challenge is that a lot of the big corporates, certainly on the spirit side of things, don't have great access, you know, to these brand franchises. You know, a lot of them are new to world brands. And they're doing other very, very clever things, Felicity, that you'll be aware of. You know, they're taking advantage of category arbitrage. And what I mean by that is, you know, you can't sell spirits into convenience stores, but you can sell wine. So, oh, let's make one of these RTDs out of wine. You're taking advantage of excise duty arbitrage. So, you know, you pay less excise on wine than you do on spirits. So a lot of these really successful ones are actually wine-based as opposed to spirits-based, but because you can do so many clever things from a production standpoint through taking out the taste of wine and putting in a whole load of new flavors, whether it's pina colada or white Russian.
Wait, which markets are you talking about? I interviewed somebody in Australia who made a limoncello prosecco, and he crossed two tax categories. The Australian Tax Office had to invent a special category just for him because of this issue. That's really interesting because within wine, there's so much resistance to doing this kind of product. But you're saying that actually this is a growth area,
a huge growth area, right? And okay, like it's not necessarily, you know, being marketed as wine, right? But the liquid is wine. And like you're seeing this a little bit, you know, down in some of the emerging markets as well. I know Brazil's a sort of big growth area for, you know, ready to drink wine that's coming up from, you know, some of the wine region in South America as well. So you are seeing, I guess, some early indications of really good innovation, you know, coming through that's sort of, you know, unlikely, I would say, because it's not necessarily, you know, being marketed as wine. But, you know, wine has, you know, a number of inherent opportunities, as I just mentioned, both in terms of distribution benefits, i.e. you can get into C-stores, and then also lower excise duty, which then brings the price down and then allows you to compete, you know, relative to spirits and get that type of, you know, $1 per unit offering, which is pretty cheap.
That is cheap. That's interesting. I'll just stay on the health thing for one more second. So the impact of cannabis, and once again, I hear a lot about this from the United States, but obviously, cannabis isn't the whole story because you don't see it elsewhere because cannabis isn't legal. How much of an impact is cannabis having on the alcohol market?
And again, I think sort of similar to the GLP piece, I mean, it's sort of chipping away gently, but it's not like marijuana didn't exist, you know, over the last 10, 20 years or so. I think what's probably changed is, you know, when it gets legalized from a recreational perspective, and you know, you get a new store that opens up in your little neighborhood of, I don't know, let's call it Brooklyn, you know, there's a little bit of a buzz around it, if you excuse the pun, as people
no.
sorry, as people yeah, just try it for the first time, right? So there's a little bit of that, right? So that's one element. I think the second element is, you know, whilst you know, cannabis is still most commonly, you know, used in sort of smoking formats, you know, there is a lot of innovation coming through in edibles, in particular gummies. So, you know, that's again, you know, adding to or taking away an occasion to a certain extent amongst a certain demographic, let's say. And then, you know, the third thing as well that I would say is that, look, it's just very cheap, right? You know, if you go to a ball game in the US and it's, you know, $23 for a Coors Light in the stand, a can of Coors Light for $23, I mean, imagine that. Or getting out your vape pen and having a bit of a puff on the vape pen, you know, what's cheaper? So I think it's not just a sort of, hey, we all want to drink cannabis. I think there's a number of reasons why, you know, cannabis, you know, might do well. But again, it's not an entirely new theme. So I don't think it explains in its entirety as to why the industry has suddenly gone from, you know, positive to negative.
Yeah, and in fact, we're recording this a day or two after there's been an earthquake decision in the United States around cannabis products, which I don't understand whatsoever, but I imagine is going to make some sort of difference to all of this equation. Do you look at THC beverages as part of your portfolio?
Well, the large cap companies that I spend most of my time sort of looking at, you know, they're obviously looking at these things, but they're not sort of dipping their toes in. You know, they're global multinationals. And until, I guess cannabis is legalized at a federal level, which it's not yet. I mean, it's sort of, you know, decriminalized and legalized at a state level, either for recreational or medicinal use. And, you know, clearly every state is slightly different in terms of how they're thinking about that. You know, until it gets federal legalization, I think it's very, very difficult for these companies to get, you know, too involved. And, you know, the reputational risk as well, you know, given that, you know, the perception of marijuana does, you know, differ quite materially across different markets. It is one that, you know, the big multinationals probably don't want to, you know, get involved in. But, you know, I think we do keep an eye on, you know, these THC beverages. You know, they're getting more distribution in certain states. You know, there's obviously a lot, you know, people like new things, and there's clearly, you know, a lot of, you know, fanfare and attention when these things get, you know, more shelf space. But it is going to be interesting to see how the regulatory environment does evolve around this. I mean, you probably, you know, heard that, what, 40% of the traffic deaths last year in the US were under the influence of marijuana, yeah, which is a pretty big number. And, you know, alcohol is regulated. It's a very, very regulated industry.
I think one of the problems, I was reading the Wall Street Journal about this, is that you can't measure the concentration in the blood accurately. So you don't know if somebody crashed their car because they were under the influence, or they crashed their car because they were hopeless because they smoked 3 days earlier. So it's interesting. Let's move on to the third one of your grouping of headwinds, social relevance. Talk about that.
So look, alcohol is something that, you know, people have been doing for, you know, 8,000 years. It's, you know, ultimately, you know, one of the things that, you know, got people, you know, together around the campfire and, you know, put their differences apart and sort of, you know, allowed, well, one of the, not the sole reason how society was formed, but, you know, it certainly contributed, I think, to, you
some know, people come some together. People think it was. Some people think, yeah, you know, the beer before bread hypothesis, that it was alcohol that got us together.
Yeah, and, you know, alcohol as a social lubricant is, a very, very, you know, important, relevant question, right? Because it's been something that's been around for so long. And the sort of the question that we asked ourselves is, you know, is that under pressure, either because, you know, young people are not coming in, or, you know, there's marijuana, there's different things to do. But I think what we do see is that, you know, younger consumers, you know, still crave those, you know, going out opportunities, especially, you know, after the pandemic. You know, young people want to go out. It's just very, very expensive, I think, to go out. And therefore, they're more selective about how they do go out. They're obviously, you know, more mindful in terms of how they drink. You know, they're doing the zebra striping and other things like that. You know, they often want to have, you know, more activities, you know, when they're out. You know, they don't like to necessarily just, you know, go out to the pub and, you know, kick the tires like the older generation would. So look, I think every generation is slightly different, but that desire to go out still, I think is incredibly real. Now, from a social sort of relevance standpoint, a couple of things that came out against that argument in the report that were really interesting was, you know, the amount of gaming that's being done by younger consumers. Mm-hmm. You know, these video games are, you know, far more addictive than, you know, when I was growing up and had a Game Boy. You know, you get bored after a couple of hours on those things, where these things, they really, you know, suck you in, and, you know, you can play all night. So, you know, you might be playing video games as opposed to going out to the pub and socializing, number one. The online gambling, you know, piece, and that's negative, yeah, for a couple of reasons, because it not only, you know, sucks your disposable income, but it's a very solitary affair as opposed to, you know, going out to a casino and, you know, having a bit of a flutter. And then the one that was sort of, I know, the one that made me fall off my chair was the proportion of alcohol-free first dates. As much as 70% amongst younger consumers, which is a pretty horrific statistic. But again,
it is horrific. I haven't heard about this. Terrify me with this. What is it, and how did you find out about it?
Well, we obviously spread our tentacles far and wide, and we've got, you know, analysts across the world. You know, we've got the ones that cover Match.com, and, you know, or the online.
You've got analysts from Match.com.
So, you know, we can leverage.
I'm just going to stop you. So, do you see romantic trends before anybody else does? Like in the office, do you go, celibacy is on the rise, or, you know, whatever?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think, the younger consumer are quite good at, playing a pretty straight bat, to the older generations in the office. But, you certainly read about this, right? I mean, I think The Economist was just carrying something the other day, there are more people staying single for longer, right? And there are, a number of reasons, why that is.
That's right. But go back to we've just identified it as the alcohol-free first date. So talk about how did you discover that and what's driving it?
So again, you double click on that number and, it turns out that 50% of first dates are online, right? So the interesting question would be, what proportion of third dates are, with alcohol? And unfortunately, I don't have that statistic, but look,
I think you need to go and get it.
I need to go and find that. But look, I think it just does, put into question this piece around alcohol as a social lubricant, the ultimate social lubricant to go out and, meet people and, get the conversation flowing. I don't know if you've ever seen any dates where people haven't got alcohol and, sometimes they're, people are just scrolling on their phones and it's probably not the most successful of dates.
It's really weird, isn't it? But this public health data that I read, they said two things about this. One was that social media had, young people use alcohol as a way of lowering inhibition. So they hate being rejected like we all do, but it's devastating when you're 17 or whatever. So alcohol was a way that you could get the courage and the other person might be more receptive. And you could always pretend it hadn't happened the next morning. You could claim you just drank too much. And now social media plays that role because you can send a very low-cost emoji and if somebody doesn't answer, it doesn't cost your ego anything. But the second thing that came out was that this question of authenticity, that they saw drinking as actually masking your true self and that if you want to talk to somebody who's not influenced by alcohol so that you can get to their true self. And I was like, well, that's just a dating disaster waiting to happen, to be honest. No wonder the birth rate is so low.
Yeah, look, I think on the first piece, I mean, you're certainly seeing a degree of fatigue, I think, with some of these dating apps. There's people playing these apps for different reasons. And, I think, there was clearly a huge novelty factor to begin with. And I think a lot of people do end up being very successful in terms of finding their, the life partner on these dating apps. But there is a little bit more, we are detecting a little bit more skepticism and, you can certainly see it in the growth numbers, from some of these dating apps are starting to come under a little bit of pressure. And look, I'd agree with your second point, right? I think it's a very valid one.
So this question about going back to gaming, how much of the market is this? I mean, Derek Thompson from The Atlantic wrote a very interesting piece this week and he called it monks in a casino. These kids that just stay in their room and they're just doing online gambling or gaming just almost 24 hours a day. But how much of that represents, young people today and how much of that is just a very unusual segment of younger people?
Well, I mean, you can look at gaming engagement, right? And, clearly over-indexes, very, very heavily towards, younger consumers, right? So, I don't know, 16 to 30, let's put it, right? And gaming engagement is much, much higher. But I think it's not just the level of gaming engagement, it's the sort of the nature of these games, right? They're not there to play, a game of FIFA, with a friend. I mean, you play these things, you get sucked into them and you play and play and play and play. And then, you play through the night, you play on the weekend. And, I think the gaming, and not every younger legal drinking age consumer is gaming, but, they're when you see it in real life, it's, as I have seen with some of the younger sort of legal drinking age consumers, I mean, there isn't anything outside of gaming in terms of your hobbies, and therefore you're not going out to the pub, you're not meeting people. Now, the pushback to that, of course, is that some of these games are quite sociable and you're interacting with others online, which I think is true. You're certainly seeing some of the alcoholic drinks companies and certainly the energy drinks companies, really piling into that occasion. But then again, if you're gaming and you're both hands are, busy, fever, beavering away on the game, you're probably not doing an awful lot of drinking during that time. But look, I think energy drinks are definitely, tapping into that occasion. The gambling is different, right? Because the gambling, is a solitary, a pursuit. And it sucks your disposable income. So again, it's very hard to quantify exactly how much of that is, to blame for I know why people are not out, but you know, you don't always win on those. You know, when you're doing online gambling, yeah, of course. So you know, it does you know, sap disposable income, and ultimately, you know, alcohol is discretionary. It's the most discretionary part of staples, I think.
So who would have thought that of all of the vices, that alcohol is a much more positive vice? I mean, it's beyond the scope of this conversation, but you have to wonder about what this means socially if significant numbers of people are behaving like this. But instead, we'll turn to your fourth headwind, which was marketing and innovation. Why is that a headwind?
So, look, I think these companies, there's a few things here if we were to sort of, you know, double-click on this. So I think if we take beer, first of all, you know, beer has historically been, you know, very, if you take the beer cycle for, I don't know, 40 years or so, there's a lot of M&A initially, right? I know 20, 30 years ago, a lot of M&A. So a lot of the growth and value in the beer industry was driven by, you know, companies gobbling each other up, taking out cost savings, and then doing the next deal. So, you know, they didn't always have a particular focus on marketing and consumer pull. And then, you know, they've always been a lot more, I'd say, distribution driven as opposed to consumer pull driven. Yeah, that's been the beer model. You know, a bit more like soft drinks, I think. And look, I think the beer companies are getting better at that, but look, I don't think they've fully cracked it. I mean, the one brand that has done a great job is obviously Guinness, but they've done a phenomenal job in terms of that. I think on the spirit side of things, you know, these are businesses with, you know, if you compare them to wine, you know, they've got incredibly high gross margins, you know, very, very profitable businesses, and that therefore, you know, funds a huge amount of investment in marketing, right? You know, the marketing as a proportion of sales for some of these companies is, you know, almost as much as 20%, which is a, you know, really, really big number, you know, more akin with beauty or luxury, you know, relative to, you know, soft drinks or beer. And so look, the point in marketing isn't that these companies are not spending enough money on marketing. The point of marketing is that, you know, in a world where, you know, we get, what is it, 1,700 marketing messages a day and we only remember five, you know, how do you make your marketing message stand out? And it's complicated, of course, right? And this is why, you know, a brand like Guinness with social media that's made that brand so successful has really, you know, nailed it. But I think the point we're also trying to make on marketing is that in a world where there's probably slower growth, if you don't change the sources of growth over the next 5 or 10 years and you just carry on with the same playbook over the last 10 or 20 years where it was sort of get out of bed and grow 5% type of environment, right? A really, really benign growth environment. If you don't change how you look to source growth, then, you know, there's a little bit of a risk that, you know, you're sort of bashing your head against the wall, as opposed to, you know, seeing the ball and playing the ball in terms of where it's going. And what I mean by that is if you just continue to push premium, which has driven a lot of the growth over the last 10, 20 years within the industry, in particular with that super cycle during the pandemic when people had more money and they traded up and, you know, had a pretty, pretty good time. If that's going to be the key growth vector for the business and you're not focusing on mainstream at a time of, you know, extreme affordability considerations, then how do you, A, diversify your growth streams on the one hand, yeah, to where the consumer is, i.e. they've got less money, and then B, how do you spend the next 20 years having recruited them in at mainstream, then trade them up the pricing ladder, you know, from mainstream to premium to super premium to ultra premium, which I think is a structural trend within this industry. So the piece on marketing is not that these companies are not spending enough money. I think that's far from the truth. It's more, are they spending it in the right way in terms of how they engage with consumers? And are they spending it behind the right growth vectors in terms of not just focusing on premium, but focus on premium and affordability?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, so this is the top right time to talk about the non-alcoholic sector because, you know, Diageo shut down Distill Ventures. There was a lot of excitement about that area, but some of the push into innovation is actually stopped. So what do you read about the non-alcoholic sector? Is this ever going, apart from beer, which has done a really good job for reasons to do with fermentation, but apart from beer, for spirits and wine, do you think the non-alcoholic sector is ever going to be significant?
Yeah, so I mean, I suppose to help answer that question, if we look at why beer is successful, first of all, so, you know, as you're aware and as your listeners will know, zero alcohol beer in some markets as much as, 15%, of the beer category, markets like Spain or Germany.
I didn't know it was that high. Which markets is it that high in?
Spain is 15. Wow. Germany is 15. And when I say zero, it's probably zero and also, 0.5 and below, right? So, these are, and why? Because the, permissibility of drinking these, because the taste profile's got so good, almost interchangeable, right? Especially if you take a brand like, Guinness Zero. I mean, it's very, very close to the original. So I think the taste profiles improves immeasurably. But then the stigma associated with them completely disappeared. I think if you went to the pub, 10, 20 years ago and asked for a zero beer, they'd sort of look at you as if, well, you've got a bit of a problem, mate. Whereas now it's very, very normal, for people to, have one real beer, one, zero beer, or even to mix a real beer with a zero beer. I mean, you see all sorts of things happening. I mean, it's also, very good to protect your license to trade, and offering choice, I think, when you're speaking to the regulator, also is, very good from an advertising standpoint. When you're trying to get into the sports, with Guinness Zero or Heineken Zero. So look, I think it's successful because not only have they made a product that's really, really good, right? And actually you want to drink. And if you don't have that, then you're sort of struggling. But B, they've gone big on the marketing. So, the company that really led the push into zero alcohol beer was Heineken, right? They took it with their mothership product with Heineken Zero. And at the time, a quarter of the Heineken brand marketing budget went behind zero. So they went big with the big brand and they put loads of money behind it. And that sort of broke the glass ceiling, I think, for zero alcohol beer to then push on and the rest is history. And we're seeing it, really taking off in the US now. And to answer your question, what about spirits and wine? Well, if we take the analogy as to why, beer's done so well, we need to get a really good product, number one, right? And I'm not sure that exists just yet, certainly from a
non-alcoholic the non-alcoholic wines are terrible, and the best among the spirits is the fake gins. Actually, they can copy some aspects of alcohol, but it's a pretty woeful category by and large, and I don't know if they can fix it because of the problem of alcohol carrying flavor and so on,
the mouthfeel. And it's difficult to do in brown spirits, of course, right? And I think the other interesting thing about the zero alcohol spirits or the zero alcohol spirits, non-alcoholic spirits category, if you will, is that, from a regulatory standpoint, you've got the real McCoy, gins that used to be gins that have been de-alcoholized on the one hand, and then you've got the others that aren't spirits-based. And there's still, I would imagine in the consumer's mind, there's not that much clarity between the two. So you've got things that are, apple ciders with some botanicals in them, for instance, that, double up as a really delicious aperitif. So look, those are the factors. I think the ones that are successful, though, that you sort of see, getting good traction, are certainly the ones that've got really cool packaging that really stand out. The ones that have got a really good sort of taste profile that, people actually, really want to drink, and the ones that got good stories behind them. So you do need to go back to the basics of good packaging, good liquids and good stories. And if you can do those three things, then you've got a fighting chance of making it successful. But, I'm not seeing as much of that from the big corporates in pushing zero, at the stage in the same way that, the beer guys did with their packaging and their liquids.
That's interesting because they've got the money to do it. So is it just conservatism? Is it their marketing departments need a shake up? What's behind that?
It's a number of things. I think it's not as easy to create the product, I think, relative to beer, number one. I think number two, some of the big companies historically, you're focusing on what's going to pay the mortgage, right? You've got to get your big brands pumping because they're going to drive the cash flows and they're going to pay the mortgage, for the business. And, big companies are not just within this sector, but across broader consumer goods, whether it's beauty, whether it's, household products. I mean, they're notoriously bad at innovation. They let small companies do the innovation and then they buy those companies and scale them up. So, we've seen that playbook, many, many times, within consumer staples. And it's not, I wouldn't say that's just an alcoholic drinks piece. But look, I don't think anyone's really, really cracked the code in terms of getting a really delicious zero alcohol beverage on the spirit side of things yet.
Okay, so the last time that we had a market that was a bear market like this was in the 1980s. And that came out of a slump because spirits started to advertise, which they're already doing and they can't do more of, I guess. Wine had the French paradox. Beer just improved itself. Do you think there's what will get alcohol out of the slump it's in, or won't it? Or is this a new low that we're just going to live with?
Yeah. So if we sort of quickly gloss over what happened, you know, during that period, we had, and this is the US in particular, right? So alcohol per capita consumption increased from about 8 litres to 10 litres between 1960 and 1980. It then dropped from 10 litres back to 8 litres between 1980 and 95. And then it grew from 8 to 9 from 95 up to the sort of peak of the pandemic. And now we've given back a litre. So it's a bit of a sort of roller coaster, if you will. I guess sort of what drove the recovery from the mid-90s, a couple of things. I think, you know, number one, you know, macro, right? Macro improved, you know, pretty decent period of prosperity, which, you know, helps to drive affordability and helps the industry, number one. But look, there's no question that marketing, you know, that was the big, you know, big era of cocktail culture developing. So marketing, you know, really stepped up. Innovation really stepped up. You know, think about all those flavored vodkas that came in and, you know, helped to bring, you know, consumers into the category. I mean, regulation was on their side as well. You know, being able to buy hard liquor, you know, on Sundays in a bunch of states, you know, being able to do tastings in rooms, which, you know, meant you could try before you buy. You know, all those things sort of contributed to that, you know, 25-year super cycle, you know, if you will. I think, you know, when you look at today, the macro is still quite tough, right? You know, we've talked a little bit about marketing, that, you know, some of it's very effective, some of it's probably not as effective. We've talked a little bit about innovation, with a lot of the innovation being driven at the ready-to-drink level, you know, which the big guys are not participating in necessarily. But if you do see ready-to-drinks start to, I don't know, moderate in terms of their pace of growth, they're, you know, getting to about 20% of industry value, spirits value at the moment. You know, if that starts to plateau, that's going to provide a bit more oxygen, you know, for the spirits industry to come back. But look, it's not clear cut exactly, you know, when that happens. But look, I think there is a playbook that these companies can do, so they're not just reliant on a cycle. Because I think, you know, there's an element of this that has to be external, right? You need an external, you know, macro consumer environment to improve. But then some of it has to be self-help driven when it comes to innovation, marketing, and just making it fun.
So if you were advising the incoming CEO of Diageo, who probably doesn't need advice from anybody, but if you were, what would your advice be?
I think it's, look, there's things he's going to do anyway, right? You know, he's going to, you know, focus on efficiencies and, you know, improving the balance sheet and, you know, the nuts and bolts of the business. But look, it's got to be, it's growth, 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 right? At the end of the day, you know, these businesses are quite high fixed cost based businesses. If you're growing, everything tends to work, right? So I think it's, in part, just not copying and pasting what you've done over the last 20 years. You know, you've got to think over the next 10, 20 years, you know, what's going to be different and how do you, you know, adapt your business model to, you know, where those growth streams are going to be. You know, there's going to be an element of premium. There's going to be an affordability piece with mainstream. There's going to be a zero alcohol piece, but you've got to go to where, you know, the consumer's going as opposed to just, you know, relying on what you did historically. So I think the fresh pair of eyes on the growth side of things is interesting. I think innovation, you know, coming back to sort of what the industry got the industry out of its sort of slump in the mid 90s was innovation in part. So look, I think there's got to be a big innovation push. Innovation works. You know, we've seen that with the ready to drinks, you know, making it fun for consumers and interesting consumers. And then I think, you know, from a sort of portfolio standpoint, you know, given it's been a really benign external environment, you know, in that environment you probably have too many brands, so you could probably start to trim the tail a little bit, and that allows you to refocus behind the biggest and baddest, most profitable opportunities, and then allows you to repurpose your marketing spend to sort of feed the biggest and baddest, you know, opportunities as well. So I think there's got to be an element of refocus, you know, for these businesses in terms of, you know, which parts of the growth part of the market they're going after. And then we've sort of touched on it a little bit. It's just trying to bring a little bit more debate and education and balance to the no safe level, you know, debate, which, you know, is being pushed, you know, very, very hard, you know, from a bottom up standpoint in markets like the US. Even if the top-down, you know, regulatory environment is a bit more benign than that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's something we've talked about in the past, but there is a sort of emergence of an austerity, a sort of Puritanism, a new austere morality around health and well-being. And, you know, austerity is always followed by a big party. It just depends on when that happens. All right. Well, look, thank you so much for your many, many insights, Ed. I really, really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Nice to be on, Felicity.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome. Thank you.